What do you remember about the 1950s? Joe McCarthy? The hydrogen bomb? Sputnik? Well, I'm willing to bet that if you're of a certain age and you grew up in the U.S., you might have vivid memories of something even more scary, the threat of polio. Maybe you couldn't swim in public schools, remember that? Or at the beach, or you couldn't go to the movies. Maybe you weren't allowed to drink from public water fountains or restaurant glasses or use public restrooms. My mom wouldn't let me have a cold drink when I was sweated up. She said, I don't want you to get polio. I mean, all because of this looming fear and its devastating effects, iron lungs, paralyzed limbs, even death. Perhaps you remember the day 50 years ago this week when scientists announced the discovery of a safe and effective polio vaccine. Maybe you were one of those polio pioneers, huh? Were you? Did you get the shot? I remember those days. Well, today we're going to look back at the years leading up to that day, April 12, 1955. Nationwide polio outbreak spurring on the race between labs to be the first to develop a vaccine, with Jonas Salk and his lab at the University of Pittsburgh claiming the prize. Maybe you didn't know there was a race. Maybe you didn't, you know, it was off your radar screen. You were too worried about polio. There were a lot of people, you know, trying to become the first to create a vaccine. That's what we'll be talking about this hour. We're going to look also at the legacy of polio vaccine research, because it did influence biomedical research in the country. We're going to talk about that. Also, interestingly, there was a botched Baxa vaccine from a California lab that changed the way the vaccine industry is regulated. Maybe you didn't know that. We're going to talk about that. It's still having reverberations through drug companies today. And although polio is a disease of the past for us here in the U.S., it's not so in other parts of the world. More than 1,000 people, most of them in Africa and India, have polio today. We're going to talk about a massive immunization campaign to eliminate polio worldwide that is focusing on those countries. So if you'd like to talk with us, a lot to talk about, 1-800-989-8255. But you can always surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Bruce Aylward is coordinator of the Global Polio Eradication Initiative at the World Health Organization in Geneva. And Dr. Aylward joins us today from his office there. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Ira. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Paul Offit is the author of The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to Today's Vaccine Crisis. That'll be coming out a little later this year. He's the chief of infectious diseases and professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and the Henley Professor of Immunologic and Infectious Diseases at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in Philly. He joins us today from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to the program, Dr. Offit.
Thank you.
You're welcome. David Oshinsky is the author of Polio, An American Story. He's the George Littlefield Professor of American History at the University of Texas, Austin. He's with us in our Science Friday studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
David, for those of us who weren't around, do you remember for that far back those fears?
I did. I was a young boy in that time, and every summer polio would descend like a plague. 50,000 children a year would be affected by the disease. Many would be paralyzed. Some would be killed. The newspapers would run literally box scores of the number of kids who got it each week. As you mentioned, swimming pools would close. Bowling alleys would close. People would try to flee the cities to get away from the germs. You mentioned your mother. My mother told me I could only play with old friends and not new friends because I had the germs of old friends, and she didn't want me to get the potential polio germs of new friends.
Was this an overblown fear? Was it real?
It was both. And by that I mean that polio is a horrific disease, and there is and the people who got it suffered dramatically. On the other hand, in comparison to many other infectious diseases, the numbers were not nearly as great, and yet the amount of money that the American people poured into polio research and the March of Dimes was absolutely extraordinary. The March of Dimes was a revolutionary organization in terms of fundraising and medical research, and really turned polio into a national crusade.
That was a private organization.
Yes,
right?
It was.
Why did we need a private organization to spearhead the drug? Where was the government? Where were our drug companies? Why, you know? It's like Jerry Lewis and muscular dystrophy.
Yes. Well, the March of Dimes really was the first, and it was the gold standard. There was very little government research at this time. In other words, there was no NIH, no big grants. Most of the granting was done by private philanthropies. And what the March of Dimes did really was most philanthropies would have two or three millionaires who would give all the money. The March of Dimes turned this on its head and had thousands of people give dimes and quarters, and so it became essentially everyone's crusade. Mm-hmm. And the March of Dimes did what the government and the drug companies do today. They did most of the medical research, and indeed they pulled off the largest public health experiment in American history in 1954. And in the process, and I think this is very important, they really revolutionized the way medical research was done in the United States. They pooled information among grantees. They gave out long-term grants, five-year grants, to university professors, not just 1 or 2 years. And if the person was good, the person got another grant. And most important of all, they pay the indirect costs of these grants. And what is so important is that Harvard tried, the National Foundation gave a grant to John Enders, who won the Nobel Prize. And he came from Harvard, and he was thrilled to get the grant in 1940, and Harvard turned it down. And the reason Harvard turned it down was it said to the foundation, who's going to pay for the heat? Who's going to pay for the laboratory costs?
Overhead.
Who's going to pay for the Bunsen burners and the monkeys?
Paul Offit, why did polio come in the summer, the threat of it at least? What was there about the summertime?
That's a very good question, and I would say that still we don't have the answer. I mean, it was an intestinal virus. I mean, it basically entered the body through the mouth or the nose. It traveled down, you know, through the esophagus into the stomach and into the small intestines, where it ultimately entered the blood. I mean, we have other intestinal viruses like rotavirus, which are a winter disease, and so I think we would argue that that it occurred because there was crowding around swimming pools, et cetera, or places where one got water. But I think the short answer is that I think it's still unclear why it is that polio was a summer disease.
Hmm. Yeah, the title of your book is The Cutter Incident: How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to Today's Vaccine Crisis. I mean, we do have this crisis. We can never have enough vaccine, no matter what kind of vaccine it seems we need. How do you connect the two?
Well, the Cutter incident was interesting in that it was there were as David alluded that when the polio vaccine first came out in 1955, five companies lined up to make it. One of them, Cutter Laboratories of Berkeley, California, made it badly, so that about 120,000 doses of polio vaccine were inadvertently contaminated with live virulent polio virus. As a consequence, about 40,000 children developed something called abortive polio, which fever, headache, stiff neck, stiff back, muscle weakness that could last up to 9 months. About 200 children were permanently and severely paralyzed, and about 10 people were killed. I think it was arguably one of the worst biological disasters that ever happened in this country. And although it was the birth of many good things, I think one of which it really was the birth of vaccine regulation. It sort of shook us out of our infancy. At the time, there were only 10 federal officials that were regulating vaccines. Very quickly, there were 150. Today, there's closer to 250. And I think vaccines now are the safest, best-tested medical products we have. One, I think, unfortunate consequence of that is that a couple years later, consequent to a lawsuit, there was a ruling that essentially was the birth of liability without negligence or liability without fault for pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies could be considered liable for their products even though they weren't negligent in designing them or making them. And that has sort of opened up a door that has, I think, made liability a very big issue for pharmaceutical companies and maybe not to society's benefit.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Aylward, I'll bet most people think that polio is gone and eradicated and gone, from vision. But there are over 1,000 people who have polio, mostly in Africa and India. What's going on over there that makes them so different?
Well, really, what this comes down to is the whole issue of I guess social justice or equity in terms of how these miracles of modern science are really shared around the world. The benefits of the polio vaccine were first available to children in America and then children in other industrialized countries very very quickly thereafter. But it took a number of years before the Sabin vaccine, which was orally administered and was available, and which was much easier to administer and probably more effective in the tropical country setting. So really, it's simply a matter of the time it took to get this new technology, so to speak, out to the people who really, to a certain degree, were going to benefit the most from it.
But we're talking 50 years now.
Well, indeed, it's 50 years. I think one of the great things, in fact, if you have to compare that 50 years to the time it took between the development of the smallpox vaccine and the eradication of that disease, that took 200 years. So you could argue that that the world is making progress on that front. But indeed, it was 1988 when the world finally really had the evidence that the polio vaccines that were available could actually interrupt transmission of this disease on a population basis and really set the stage for eradication of what David described as really a horrifying disease. And this indeed was what happened. In 1988 began the eradication initiative, and at that time, probably close to 500,000 children were still being paralyzed by this disease, which at that point was becoming increasingly unknown in the industrialized world. And today we're really dealing with the tail end of the eradication initiative. We're dealing with the last holdouts of this virus in parts of India and parts of Africa. And the places where we're still seeing it, Ira, these are places where the virus, if it were to have thought about it 10 or 15 years ago, if it were to have thought, hey, there's an eradication initiative, I need to pick where I'm going to have my last stand, it would head for a place with very dense population, tropical climate, very low sanitation levels, and low immunization coverage. And those are the characteristics of the areas of India and Africa where we're still battling this disease.
David Oshinsky, tell us about why. And I think most people never realize there was a race. Mm-hmm. Jonas Salk was seen as a god after he came out with this, but there were other people who were racing. Give us an idea of the flavor of what was happening and why he won.
Well, there really were two major theories. One was a killed virus vaccine, where you would kill the virus and inject it into the system, and it would kind of goose the immune system into producing antibodies that would produce immunity. Most virologists thought that the better vaccine was the Sabin vaccine, and that was a live virus vaccine.
But it was crippled.
It was attenuated,
right.
Very, very carefully weakened, but strong enough to produce a natural infection in the body, but weak enough, hopefully, not to cause polio itself. And clearly, I think most virologists are on Sabin's side. The difference was that Salk's was seen as safer. In other words, if the virus were completely killed, it could not cause polio, and it also could be done more quickly. The other issue, and the important issue, is that we mustn't really forget that there were dozens of important polio researchers who really put the building blocks together. And the National Foundation didn't really care whether the person was Jewish or Gentile, male or female. Salk and Sabin were Jews who had a tough time going to medical school and getting internships, but got jobs with the foundation and grants. And some of the best polio research was done by women who today are completely forgotten.
So we'll talk about that in a second. I just want to remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with David Oshinsky about we continue to rewrite history about women. You know, talk about Nobel Prize winners who have been left out. This is another case.
It is.
Who were the women we were talking
about? Two of the major, Dorothy Horstmann of Yale University, who made a revolutionary breakthrough. She was the first to show that poliovirus actually circulated in the blood before it went into the central nervous system. And until that discovery, a vaccine would have been irrelevant because the battle and the antibodies are produced in the blood. And the other is Isabel Morgan from Johns Hopkins, who actually was ahead of Jonas Salk in what you might call the race for a killed virus vaccine. She had produced immunity in monkeys from this killed virus vaccine. And at the age of 38 in 1949, at the very height of her career, she left science to get married and raise a family and never came back to polio research. And I honestly believe that had Isabel Morgan stayed in science, there's a possibility we'd be talking today about the Morgan vaccine, not about the Salk vaccine.
Really?
Yes.
But Paul Offit, in the end, it was Sabin's vaccine that took over. Right.
Well, I think in the end, which is to say currently, Sabin's vaccine was replaced finally and completely in 1998 by Salk's vaccine. And I think, and this is going to sound sort of heretical, but I think that if I had to say the one person who I think was the most underrated during this entire process of polio vaccines, it actually was Jonas Salk. Even though, obviously, the public and the press knew him well, he was not considered in high regard by his fellow scientists. He was considered in many ways to be sort of a lightweight. lightweight. And if you look at what he conceived, he believed that you could essentially induce lifetime immunity by taking poliovirus and killing it completely with formaldehyde. And at the time, people thought that this kind of lifetime immunity, so-called convalescent immunity, would only be the consequence of natural infection or would only be the consequence, as David alluded to before, of a live, weakened form of the virus. Well, Salk, frankly, showed and proved it in his papers that you could get this so-called anamnestic or memory response with booster doses of the inactivated polio vaccine. And he was right, and he was the one who coined the term immunological memory. That was really him. And although now I think we understand the molecular basis of that, that at the time was a very novel concept for which I think he was never appropriately given credit. He was never on the short list for the Nobel Prize. He never even made it into the National Academy of Sciences. And I think his concept of immunologic memory, frankly, should have gotten him consideration for the Nobel Prize, but certainly he was far from that.
David, you agree?
I agree. I fully agree. I think Salk was a wonderful scientist as well as a humanitarian. And I think that once he became the celebrity scientist, in other words, with his face on Time magazine and going to the White House to be feted by President Eisenhower and getting the Congressional Medal of Freedom, he was, in a sense, blackballed by scientists who believed that you stayed in the lab and you did not court publicity. Jonas Salk, there's some debate today as to how much publicity he courted and how much came to him, but it's clear that once he became a celebrity scientist, he became a pariah in the scientific community.
Is that right? Oh, we keep hearing rumblings that there are still possible strange side effects from the polio vaccine, that some of it might have been contaminated with a simian, with a monkey virus. You've heard of those?
I have. Dr. Offit could talk about that better than I, but SV40 was one that was – you have to realize at this time poliovirus was being grown in monkey kidney tissue, and they really were not aware of other simian viruses that might also be in that monkey kidney tissue and that might contaminate the vaccine. And the Salk vaccine early on was – contaminated, but there really appears to be no evidence that I know of, and Dr. Offit might talk a little bit more, that this virus had any effect on human beings.
All right. Well, we're going to have to take a break and go back and recount with Dr. Offit about this incident. So stay with us. We'll be right back talking about the 50th anniversary of the Salk vaccine and taking your calls, 1-800-989-8255. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Talkative Nation Science Friday. Listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the 50th anniversary of the first polio vaccine. My guest, Paul Offit, author of the upcoming book, The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to Today's Vaccine Crisis. David Oshinsky, author of the current book, Polio, an American Story. And Paul Aylward, is a doctor at the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Paul, I was talking about this contamination that people keep talking about that still might be affecting people contaminated with the monkey SV40.
Right. What happened actually was in 1960, there was a man named Maurice Hilleman, who was just, I think, one of the greats of vaccines and who passed away actually just this past Monday, who stood up and said that he had detected a monkey virus in these monkey kidney cells, as David had stated before, that basically was contaminating those cells. And it was hard to detect it, but he finally figured out a way to detect it. It was the 40th monkey virus known, and so it was called SV40 or simian virus 40. And at this point, it was clear that, especially with Sabin's vaccine, because Sabin's was a live, weakened form of the virus. It wasn't killed with formaldehyde, and apparently SV40 was largely susceptible to killing with formaldehyde. People were worried that, you know, now millions of people had been inoculated with this SV40 virus, and it was within a class of viruses, you know, the so-called polyomaviruses, which can cause cancer. So obviously, people were very concerned that this virus was inadvertently given to people and would have caused cancer. And so very quickly, frankly, within a matter of just a few years, it became arguably the best-studied mammalian virus of man, because we put a lot of money into trying to understand it. And largely people were were comforted by the fact that it didn't appear to grow well in people. Grew in monkeys, didn't grow in people, and it really just laid dormant then until the 1990s when a researcher at the National Cancer Institute, Michelle Carboni, found essentially genetic remnants of this virus in unusual cancers, cancers of the bone called osteosarcoma, cancers of the lung like mesothelioma, and so now one worried whether this vaccine had caused these cancers. But I think the epidemiology now largely refutes that. Clearly, there are people who have genetic evidence for that without ever that virus, without ever having received those vaccines. It looks like the virus was likely circulating in the human population before those vaccines were ever administered. And so I think that when the final story is written on this, I think we'll realize that SV40 virus probably did no harm.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Aylward, in Africa and India, the challenges, what are the cultural challenges toward vaccinating the kids there, and which kind of vaccine, the Sabin or the Salk type, is being tried there?
Well, the vaccine that's used that really underpins the whole global eradication program is the Sabin vaccine. That's the oral vaccine that followed the Salk vaccine by a few years. And the advantages of it were really the fact that it's oral meant that it could be given by people who had very little training. And also there's secondary spread of the vaccine because it's a live virus. It could spread and it could protect contacts of the people who were actually immunized. And then finally, gave good intestinal immunity. And as Paul mentioned earlier, this is a virus that infects you through the intestines. So that intestinal immunity gives you an earlier barrier to, certainly community-wise, to the further transmission of this disease. So there are a number of reasons. And then finally, it's actually a cheaper vaccine, or has been a cheaper vaccine than the Salk vaccine. So there's a number of reasons that it really has underpinned the work of eradication, certainly in developing countries. And the big challenge, the biggest challenge we face actually is not so much cultural as simply logistics. To give you a sense of the kind of polio campaigns that are ongoing right now, just this past week, there's a campaign that stretches all the way from Ethiopia and Somalia right across to Mali and Guinea. It's going to immunize over 100 million children by 1 million volunteers in about, I think it's 22 countries in total. So this is a massive logistical operation in areas where you have civil conflict. Sometimes you certainly have very, very weak health infrastructures and logistical networks in general. So the big challenge is just getting that vaccine into the hands of communities and into parents to be able to immunize children.
Yeah.
In India, the challenge, to give you a sense of the scale, 170 million children will be immunized over a 4 to 5 day period during the campaigns that are used to interrupt transmission of the virus in that country. So the big challenge really is logistics. Now, the other challenges, you mentioned cultural challenges that we face, are increasingly important because what's happening at this point in the program is we're having to return to these communities multiple times, month after month, to really hyper-immunize the community to get the job finished and stop the virus. And in some of these communities, very, very poor communities, often marginalized communities where this virus still exists, they're very suspicious as to why people are coming, why they want to immunize their children month after month against this disease that there's very, very little of. And so rumors start, rumors about is there actually another reason for this? Is it actually a contraceptive? Is it HIV infected, et cetera? So all these other issues have certainly been an important part of what's had to be dealt with along the way to eradication, and they're increasingly important the closer we get, and the more intense activities are in these final reservoirs.
David, but giant immunization programs, that was the hallmark of the whole polio vaccination to begin with, wasn't it?
It was in 1954. More than 1.5 million American children were immunized against polio. Half were given a placebo, half were given the real vaccine, and it was that test that was run in a voluntary fashion. The federal government took virtually no role. It was all done by the National Foundation.
Now let's talk about the National Foundation.
Yes.
That dates all the way back to President Roosevelt, had polio.
That is correct.
Was he instrumental in getting this going?
He in fact was a spiritual force behind the National Foundation. FDR got polio in 1921 at the age of 39, and once he got it, there was a sense that everyone was vulnerable to polio. FDR spent his entire life trying to find a cure for polio. He never did. He was paralyzed from the waist down. When he died in 1945, he was still paralyzed. He was put on the dime because he was sort of the father of the March of Dimes. And Roosevelt really decided that an organization had to be set up to help the victims and also to provide the research that would get a vaccine. So he is the force behind the March of Dimes.
And how did it meld into the March of Dimes from the National?
Well, the March of Dimes is really sort of the fundraising arm of the National Foundation. And the National Foundation raised hundreds of millions of dollars.
I remember we all went out with little cans and collecting dimes in
it. It was a national crusade. The Foundation and the March of Dimes raised more money than all other medical charities combined, with the exception of the Red Cross. And there actually was a backlash that too much money was being raised for a disease that was relatively uncommon. It was horrific, but relatively uncommon. And what the March of Dimes said was, we made a pledge to the American people, and our pledge is that you give us your money, we will find you the vaccine, and we will end polio. And they made good on that pledge.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Bill in Florida. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm glad to be able to talk to you this afternoon on Science Friday, one of my favorite. I was calling about me being inoculated when I was in grade school, and they actually scratched us with a piece of glass, and I forget what they did after that, but I knew we got a big sore, and my parents were concerned because I may come home and be ill for a few days, but they said that was one sure way of determining whether or not the vaccine worked or not.
Sounds like smallpox vaccination.
Oh, but I got the two mixed up.
It's okay. We do it all the time. Dr. Offit?
Sounds like smallpox.
All right. Well, I'm immune to smallpox in case it ever happens.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's another disease that we don't hear much about lately.
Well, I think what is interesting is that this was a public health experiment in which no one was sure the vaccine would work. No one was fully sure how safe it was. And yet it was a testimony to the power of the March of Dimes and also to the fear of polio, that millions of parents would line their children up for a vaccine that was seen as quote-unquote questionable.
And could you get it for free?
Yes, at this time you could get it for free. You got it in public schools for free. The American Medical Association ran a big campaign after that to try to get it done in doctors' offices in a paid doctor's visit, claiming that these free inoculations were socialized medicine. But at this time, it was done in schools, and it was free.
Giona in Arizona. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there. Yes, go ahead.
This is Gloria in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I couldn't read your name.
Okay,
go ahead.
Gloria, thank you for taking my call. Today is a really important day in my life. It's the anniversary of my husband's death 3 years ago from the effects of polio. He was not quite 53 years old when he died, but he contracted polio here in Tucson in 1955 when he was only 6 years old. And the story that I heard was that his sister had received the vaccine, but he didn't. And I don't know, you know, what the reason for that was, if they'd run out. I really don't know. I was here at that time, too, but I didn't know them. And I know I received it, and my family did. But
there was an age difference, was there not, a cutoff?
There was an age difference for the trials in 1954, But after that, in 1955, and for a while thereafter, there was a shortage of vaccine.
Must have been.
Yeah, and I know a good friend who, in Wisconsin, the town ran out of vaccine, so only kids in elementary school were vaccinated. He was a year too young, and he said, you know, my friends got the vaccine, and I got the virus.
Right. Well, he got the virus because his sister got the vaccine, and I remember his mother telling me that she never thought he would catch anything because he was so healthy. And, of course, that has nothing to do with it, I don't think, because I went to school with many children who contracted it and some who died. But my husband, though, was such, of course, an advocate for the vaccine. And later on, after I met him and I was a teacher, and he would come to visit my class, and he was very badly disabled. Of course, it was obvious he'd had something awful wrong with him. the kids would say, "What happened to you?" And he'd say, "I have had polio." And they'd say, "What is that?" And it was his hope, you know, that the whole world would ask that question.
Yeah.
But thank you for taking my call. I just, he suffered so much, but he ended up really living a full life and having a wonderful attitude. And in spite of all, you know, not being able to take part in a lot of things. But I just hope that people in Africa and other places will get over their hysteria or their fear of taking the vaccine.
Well, thank you for taking time to share his story with us.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Take care. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the polio vaccine anniversary this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Offit, this whole, you know, Dave is talking about this effort to raise money, the dimes and whatever, the shortages. Are we going to have to do that to get our own flu vaccines today? Are we going to have to start raising our own money and sending the cans around because we don't seem to have enough to go around? We hear about the simian, you know, the bird virus that may be heading our way if it mutates.
The bird flu you're talking
about. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not saying, I mean, the bird, right, avian flu, right.
Right. I mean, if you look at 1955, there were 26 companies that made vaccines. By the early 1980s, that had been reduced to 18, and today there's basically four big companies that make vaccines. And although some of that has been merger, most of it really has been dropout. I mean, the big vaccine makers, Eli Lilly at that time, for example, don't make vaccines anymore. And I think the main reason, I think, is sort of liability aside, is that it's just not a very profitable business. You know, you take a vaccine maybe once or a few times in your life, whereas, you know, drugs, you know, like lipid-lowering agents or neurologic drugs or pain medicines, you take every day. So, I mean, a drug like Lipitor, for example, has a worldwide market that is greater than the entire worldwide market for all vaccines. So, therefore, the vaccine infrastructure has, to some extent, crumbled. I mean, it's certainly dramatically shrunk. And if you ask the question, are we in a position to make enough flu vaccine, were that H5N1 virus, you know, this bird flu in Southeast Asia, capable of mutating and then being spread easily from person to person? I think the answer is no. So how do we build up that infrastructure? How do we, you know, make it more profitable, or frankly just more worthwhile for companies to get in the vaccine business? And I think that's our challenge, and it's a challenge we absolutely need to meet.
Do we have any suggestions? Do you have any suggestions for us?
Yeah, I think there has one of the wonderful things about the National Foundation, and it's still relevant today, was it was a tremendous pull mechanism. I mean, basically, they took the risk out of research and development. They said, look, here, Jonas Salk has made this vaccine. I'll give you a protocol on how to make it. I'll buy the vaccine even, you know, before you distribute it, even if it's shown not to be effective, you know, so it'll take the risk out of it for you. And I think the lesson from that is that I think that can still be done today. I think that companies can, for example, be coerced in or be pulled into moving to, say, a mammalian cell-based technology and reverse genetics and just update, you know, upgrade the technology to allow for you know, better, quicker vaccine to be made. Because, frankly, I mean, to do that on their own would cost, you know, $800 million or $1 billion to make a vaccine that costs $8 a dose. It's just, you know, it doesn't make sense for them.
David, you have any thoughts on this?
I think Paul is right. Although I do believe that the kind of voluntarism that was around in the 1950s, the kind of optimism, the belief that infectious disease was on its way out and we'd be talking about heart disease and cancer, was a fleeting moment in our history. And we have now begun to rely much more on drug companies and on the federal government. And the notion of bringing back that kind of voluntarism today, a national crusade against a single disease, I think would be extremely difficult.
Ari, this is Bruce. I think
quick, Bruce, I've got 30 seconds.
Yeah, if we're on the issue of polio, and the book ends to this great story of polio. On the one hand, you have the extraordinary foundation, the March of Dimes, but on the other end of it, Rotary International is this foundation that's putting $500 million into the effort to eradicate this disease. So I think there's some tremendous examples still of great volunteerism, and it's still part of the story of polio.
Thank you all for taking time to tell us that story. Bruce Aylward, at the World Health Organization in Geneva, David Oshinsky, author of Polio, an American Story, professor at the University of Texas at Austin, Paul Offit, author of the upcoming book, The Cutter Incident, How America's First Polio Vaccine Led to Today's Vaccine Crisis, out later this year. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.